Part 5. The Remedy. 1693. 1. There were so many women in love and in trouble in the city of Manhattan that Maria hadn't time for all who came in search of a charm or a cure. Often a dozen or more waited in the garden, some disguised by shawls or cloaks, others so desperate they didn't care who might spy them visiting the witch's house. What was a witch if not a woman with wisdom and talent? Here in New York, such things were not a crime. Maria's clients perched on benches or sat in the dewy grass counting out pieces of silver, removing wedding bands, reciting small prayers that Maria Owens might help them find health or solace or love. When she looked out the window to see how many women were in need, she was overwhelmed. A woman who had renounced love should not be so close to so much emotion. It would surely affect her. Love was contagious. It passed from soul to soul. It woke a person up and shook her even when she wanted to be left alone. There were times when Maria looked in the black mirror to search for a client's fate, and all she could see was Samuel Diaz. She had no heart, she was sure of it. And yet something inside of her ached. "I could be your assistant," Faith said as they looked out the window at the women waiting there. "In Brooklyn, people came to me to be healed." She had recently learned how to construct figures out of the bark of the black hawthorn. When melted over a fire, the love for the wrong person would melt as well, and a client would be freed of foolhardy desires. "Well, that was in Brooklyn," Maria responded. "They should not have gone to a girl." "I know more than you think I do," Faith insisted. She knew the expression on a woman's face when she realized she had only a few more breaths to take in this life. She knew that when she was in a cemetery at night, she could hear the heartbeats of the dead. She knew that a girl whose father doesn't want her will be both stronger and weaker than she might have been had he ever loved her. "I'll take the one seeking revenge," she chirped. "We don't do that here," Maria said. "You do all sorts of things," Faith said archly. "For the benefit of those in need." "Maybe you don't think I have the power." "That's not true. I believe in you. You're just not ready." "I have been ready since I was 6 years old and you left me." Maria stepped back as if slapped. "I told you I never wanted to leave you. I had no choice." "I thought we all had choices," Faith said, her gaze turning to ice. "If you hadn't gone to Massachusetts, none of it would have happened." The lies Martha had told Faith had done damage, and she carried the scars of abandonment. She went inside and sat on the floor beside Keeper. He had a distant, somewhat removed character and resembled Faith in that way, but now he put his head on her lap and she stroked his fur. Here she was in her own home, and she was still invisible, her true self lurking in the shadows. Every witch wishes for a pair of red boots, and Faith had hoped her mother would grant her a pair as a gift on her 13th birthday. But when the day came, she was given a sky blue shawl. She didn't need protection. She didn't need luck. She wanted her one and only life, and the freedom to live as she pleased. She had been paid well by her clients, which was a good thing. She would order her own boots at the cobbler's. Anyone who had the sight and the ability to see inside Faith to her core would see the damage there, the iron wound, the nights in a locked room, the open window, the cemetery in Gravesend, the salty land and the seabirds in the sky, the loneliness, the bitter taste in her mouth, the father who never showed himself, the mother who wished to believe that all was well with her daughter when there was a crack in everything and the world was coming apart. Faith would be ready for magic when she said she was ready, not when her mother allowed it. She had said yes to magic years ago in the Flatlands, with the salt stinging her eyes, so that she almost cried. Not that she had the ability to do such a thing, not then and not now. Maria Owens could cry. But that was unusual for a witch, and was likely a sign of weakness in Faith's opinion. Faith herself was nothing like that. Even if Maria had wanted to see inside her daughter, Faith had blocked her from doing so. It was a murky and solemn spell she had worked at the Mineta Stream, a fitting place for dark acts. She had used her own blood and hair and the bones of a small sparrow, and had thereby grown invisible to the person who loved her best in the world. A part of her longed to be saved from the path she had taken, so that she could become the person she might have been if she hadn't been a stolen child, if she hadn't learned early on that there was evil in the world. What plunged her further into the dark was an ordinary day when she was cleaning out the barn after Finney moved out. She stumbled upon an old satchel, one that belonged to Samuel Diaz. Inside was a rope, a book of maps, and a letter from Maria Owens, left for him when the Queen Esther docked in Boston after their trip together from Curaçao. He had kept it all this time, though he could only tolerate reading it once, for once was more than enough. I don't know what might have happened between us. I am in search of a man named John Hathorne. He is my fate and the father of my child. Faith sat back on her heels, her heart pounding. She had never known her father's name. To her eyes, the letters were sharp as glass. She could hear her mother calling to her from the garden, where she was planting rosemary and mint. Instead of answering, Faith lay in the straw. She paged through the book of maps until she reached Essex County. Navigators can never touch a map without plotting the journey ahead, and Samuel had marked the path with spots of ink. Faith thought of the unfurled paper that told her future, and how vengeance had settled inside her like a bird in a nest, fitted close to her heart. From the start, she had been ready to seek revenge. That evening, she had supper with her mother, a cod baked with spring onions and cream. Then Faith went up to her room under the eaves. She had been trained to keep her feelings to herself. She set the lock and burned a black candle. Her father was the magistrate who had judged the women who stood before him with their wrists in iron chains and their legs bound by ropes. If she reached back inside of herself, she could recall his appearance, a tall man who had stared as if willing her to disappear. When your father doesn't love you, a stone forms inside of you, hard and sharp enough to pierce through bone. The dark was rising in her soul, and she was glad of it. She was at the age when innocence seems like a flaw. Do what you must, or do what you will. Adhere to the rules, or break them in two. Faith would not be 13 forever, but that's what she was now. She had picked up her red boots at the cobbler, and they fitted her perfectly. Before she left, she wrote a note to her mother, folded it, and placed it upon her bedside table. Faith had been stolen once before, and she wanted Maria to know that this time she was leaving of her own accord. She would stand before the magistrate, and she would judge him, although she already knew she would find him guilty. She would see that he paid the price for all that he'd done. On the day that Faith left New York, the air swirled with a cold mist that soon changed to a smattering of hail, for out at sea there was an unexpected storm that raced toward harbors and coastlines. Everything was white, air and sea and sky, but the weather and the high seas didn't deter her. She had looked in the black mirror and had seen that it was her fate to go to Salem. She paid for her passage with coins earned from women in need of her talents, those who wished for revenge and escape and reprisal, and she silently thanked them as she stood on the dock, equally ready for revenge. The ship's purser thought the coins were false, for Faith was only a girl, and how had a girl come into possession of such a sum? Then he rubbed one with his kerchief and found that it shone in his hands. "Go on, then," he told Faith, though his gaze was on Keeper. But that beast stays. Faith certainly didn't intend to leave Keeper behind, for the loyal creature would have leapt into the freezing river to follow her if he must. When the purser went off to see to his other duties, Faith withdrew a figure made of hemlock bark. She held a match to it and recited an invocation from the Book of the Raven, watching as the wood melted into a black pool. Each time she recited a spell from the text, she felt a change inside her, as if her blood burned more hotly and her bones became sharper. Her hair was so darkly red, it looked black in the shadows, as if the person she once was and the child Martha had stolen had magicked into one being. She was made of blood and heart and soul, and it was blood magic that she practiced. She was no one's little girl now. From a distance, she appeared to be a full-grown woman, and men were attracted to her. She seemed different than other girls. It was the manner in which she looked at the men who stared at her, so directly, as if to see who they truly were. When the purser returned, he no longer noticed Keeper, and failed to say another word about the wolf's presence. In fact, the purser's vision was cloudy, and would remain so. It was the first time Faith had used left-handed magic for her own selfish reasons, and later in the evening, when she bit into a slice of bread she'd brought along for her supper, she tasted blood and found that a tooth had broken. Blood magic had a price. Faith felt a chill, and she wondered if she was about to go too far. What you send out comes back to you threefold. What you give to the world returns in kind. Blood begets blood. She huddled close to Keeper to stay warm. Several of the sailors looked her over, for a girl of 13 traveling alone was considered fair prey. Keeper growled low down in his throat to warn them. But that was not the only thing that kept the sailors away. It was Faith's silver eyes, cold as coins. It was how she appeared to be one thing, a red-haired girl, and then suddenly she seemed to be a woman, with black hair it was best not to cross. They arrived in the morning light, with Salem glittering before them in the cold spring sun. The harbor had nearly frozen solid, even though the new leaves on the trees gleamed green. Men in rowboats had to cut through the forming shell of blue ice so that the ship might dock. It was foul weather, and people on board whispered it was a sign of foul things to come. As for Faith, she pricked her finger on a piece of wood, and her blood boiled on the deck, and red steam rose into the chilly air. She remembered little of arriving in Salem when she was a babe, only the bumpy carriage ride and the deep forest and the trees with black leaves that were strewn along the path to an imposing house with diamond-patterned glass windows. The docks were quiet now because of the storm, and Faith's red boots made a clicking sound on the ice. She went to a tavern where there were sailors who were more raucous than usual, trapped on land as they waited for the ice to thaw and their ships to set sail. When Faith took a table, no one disturbed her as they might had she been another girl who had wandered in unaccompanied. They were wise enough to let her be, for she had a protector who lay at her feet, his eyes glinting. Not one of the men in the tavern had ever seen a dog that looked like this one. The girl and her beast appeared as a single creature, that had been joined in some wicked way, she in her black cape, he with his long black fur. A young serving maid was told to wait on her, for the older server could already tell this red-haired girl was trouble. Faith asked for 2 bowls of stew, one for herself, one for Keeper, and a pot of boiling water for her own brew. Tea was dear and often unavailable, and so Faith carried her own courage tea. She placed a tarnished silver coin on the table. She could see the serving girl's hunger, as well as a silence she had been trained for. The girl was being mistreated on a regular basis. Across the room, the owner of the tavern was watching them with a lazy eye. He had the nerve to nod at Faith. Is he the one? She asked the girl. The maid was quick to look over her shoulder and even quicker to turn her gaze away.
I don't know what you mean. He's nothing.
If you say he is, I should believe you. Faith knew from her own experience there were times when it was impossible to do anything other than lie.
I want to find a man named John Hathorne, she went on to say.
When there wasn't a flicker on the serving maid's face, Faith set another coin on the table. The server swept the silver into her hand before anyone could see.
You'd do better to stay away from the magistrate, she murmured. She confided that a cousin of hers had been brought up on charges and was awaiting trial. Her only crime was to have taken a walk with another woman's betrothed. She'd been accused of witchery shortly thereafter. Most of us don't dare to say his name aloud.
Do I look as though I'm afraid of any man? Faith's voice was soft but steady.
And you shouldn't be either.
She reached into her satchel and handed the girl a figure stitched from red cloth and black thread.
Burn this, and the man causing you trouble will disappear.
Will he die?
The mild serving girl was shocked by the idea, despite her wish to be rid of her abuser. In her experience, punishment came with every attempt at freedom.
He'll only disappear.
When the girl continued to appear nervous, Faith added, to Rhode Island or Connecticut, not to hell, just far enough away not to bother you. Faith and Keeper were given two heaping bowls of stew, and by the time they left, the serving girl had managed to unearth the address of the magistrate's house, south of the courthouse on Washington Street. Faith's breath came hard as she walked through town. The streets were slippery, and the roofs of houses looked slate blue in the dusk. She saw the elm trees before long, the leaves unfurling, the black bark slick and wet with melting ice. The temperature had risen, and the ice storm was all but forgotten. Now that she had returned, Faith remembered the banks of white phlox in bloom, and the boy she had waved to, and the shock of her mother's face when she saw him. She felt her heart beat faster as she approached the door. Her heart had been beating just as fast on the day they ran away from the little boy in the garden and the woman who was calling out to him. Keeper went off toward the woods, where he could go unnoticed, for he certainly would not be welcome here. Faith, however, was just what Ruth Gardner Hathorne had been looking for. There was a hired woman who came to help with the laundry, and another to cook on the Sabbath, but the household work was never done. When Ruth opened the door to find a lovely girl in need of work, one who declared herself an orphan, but solemnly promised that she could cook and bake and clean as well as anyone, and had no aversion to using strong lye and washing sheets in the large kettle set over a fire pit in the yard, Ruth Hathorne thanked the Lord for this day and for his wisdom. Caring for six children had worn her down. This girl with nowhere to go was a godsend.
You must be freezing, Ruth said as she drew the girl inside. Snow in April means a hot summer to come.
Ruth was a kind-hearted woman. You didn't need magic to discern that. All you had to do was gaze into her calm blue eyes. She had been a year older than Faith when she was married with no say in the matter, having lost her parents to exile in Rhode Island because they were Quakers and considered to be enemies of the Puritan colony. Her experience had caused her to be generous to girls who had nothing other than their own abilities, for she wished someone had come to her rescue and let her be a girl a while longer. Perhaps then she might have had a choice in whom she was to wed. She no longer thought about the years when she stood at the garden gate, her hands gripping the posts, wondering what would happen if she walked down Washington Street and just kept walking through the colony, through Connecticut, going as far as she could. But she had the children, after all, and the fact that her husband paid her little attention suited her fine. He assumed she was still a foolish girl who had cried when he took her to bed and wept when she was confronted with running a household at such a tender age. He thought she knew nothing at all,
but she'd learned quite a bit during their years together. She had seen the mud on his shoes, back in the time when he would disappear at night. She remembered the woman with black hair who came to knock at their door. If anything, these things made her even more compassionate to those who had nothing. For no matter how fine her house was, or how much china and silver were in her pantry, she sometimes wished she could change places with them. "I hope you'll be happy here with us," she told the reserved girl who had appeared at the door, calling herself Jane. Faith had given the last name she'd been made to use in Brooklyn, when she was her other self, the well-behaved girl. To Ruth's eyes, she looked in need of a good meal and a place to lay her head. "I'm sure I will be," Faith assured her. She was now fully the obedient girl who never talked back. She had a certain smile when she acted this part, a shy, innocent expression. "Then you were meant to be here." Ruth was happy to lead the girl through the house, reciting a litany of what her duties would be. The snow had all but ended and was just a flutter of soft flakes. The April sun was strong, and beneath the ice the world was already green. It would be a perfect day. Ruth Gardner Hathorne showed Faith the cot and the scullery where she could sleep, and the peg where she could leave her damp coat. And if the inappropriate red boots the girl wore gave Ruth pause, it was too late. The offer to work had been extended, and the girl had hugged her as if Ruth were her own mother, then carefully hung her coat upon the hook. Two. A woman who loses a child twice will be acquainted with sorrow, and yet the second loss will hurt just as much as the first. It is a snake that circles around to bind you hand to foot, heart to soul. If it comes to pass that the child runs away again, there is no magic strong enough to bring her back to you. In the natural order of things, children do leave, but not with bitterness and in secrecy. Maria knew Faith was gone before she opened the door to her daughter's room. She had dreamed of a dark wood where the birds were silent. She saw the book of the raven in a hollow tree. "I know more than you think I do," Faith had said in the dream. Maria could hear her voice, but the girl was nowhere to be seen. She awoke in a panic, and sure enough, the window in Faith's chamber was open, and there were footprints in the damp grass. On the bedside table was a note, written with red ink on black paper. "Do not follow me. You should have told me who my father was. If you try to stop me, then you will be the one I never forgive. This is my life to live." Making her way to the farm in the Bowery, Maria went immediately to Finney, who seemed to know Faith better than anyone. Finney was working in the garden, the white dog digging up mud to bury a bone, but he put down his shovel when he spied Maria. Why would she run off, Maria wanted to know, and to Massachusetts of all places? Finney told Maria of Faith's vision in Brooklyn, in which she had to cross through hell to reach home. They'd assumed the vision had been of Hellgate in the river, but perhaps there was another meaning entirely, and it was her fate to return to Salem.
"She's as smart a girl as there ever was," Finney assured Maria. "Surely she's got her reasons to go." But Maria disagreed.
"It's a dangerous place, and no matter how smart she might be, she's only a girl."
"If you decide you want to go after her, I'll leave with you today."
Finney insisted they go first to Catherine for advice, and although Maria felt humiliated to ask for another woman's help in such a personal matter, she agreed. She had a new admiration for those who came to her for cures, for they opened themselves to reveal their most private thoughts and deeds, an act that now mortified her. "Have you not worried about your daughter?" Catherine asked Maria. "No more than any mother would," Maria said. It was a wonder how those you loved best were often the ones you could not fully see. "She's gone over to the dark," Catherine told her.
When Maria's expression was still puzzled, Catherine explained.
You didn't want to know, so it was easy for her to fool you. She works left-handed.
No, that's impossible. Maria looked up at Finney, who couldn't meet her eye. Isn't it?
She's a good-hearted girl, Finney assured Maria. No one is saying she's not, but she was locked away for 5 years. It could turn anyone.
You had lost her before she left for Massachusetts. Catherine had the little dog on her lap, ignoring how muddy he was. Now let's see if you can get her back. Catherine filled a glass bowl with cool, clear water. She placed 2 sticks of bramble into the bowl, which helped to invoke the spirit of the person in question, along with a stalk of thistle for protection. The water turned black, the better to see into. On one side of the bowl was the future as it was now. On the other side, the future as it might be. There was fire on one side. Waves on the other that leapt from the bowl, splashing onto the table. Catherine turned to Finney. When the girl dreamed of hell, how did she cross over?
Through water, Finney said.
The women exchanged a look. They both knew that meant a drowning, to prove witchery was at work. Maria rose to her feet, thanking her hosts, ready to leave, telling Finney he need not accompany her. She would find her daughter. Catherine held her back.
Listen to me, she said. I have seen this before. I know black magic. I have seen more than you could imagine. Following the girl isn't the answer. I know what people are capable of in Essex County. I know what they did to me.
But this is her fate, not yours. She has to cross through hell to come out on the other side. Otherwise, she will be trapped in her own darkness.
Maria shook her head. She held back tears that burned her. There's only one way for you to help, Catherine told her. The first and second rules combined.
Maria saw then that Catherine was older than she appeared to be, older than any mortal should be. Women in the Durant family lived too long, and in the end lost everyone they had ever loved. That was why Catherine had come to New York to begin anew. She was grateful to Faith for invoking the 10th and giving her a new life with Finney, a good and decent man. She would now return the favor and help Maria win her daughter back from the dark side.
If you want your daughter, save someone. That's the way to win back her life. Wait, and the chance will come to you. When it does, don't let it pass you by.
For weeks, Maria looked out the window, barely able to eat or sleep. Days passed, and then one bright morning, a minister's wife came to Maiden Lane. Catherine had vowed that a sign would appear, and now it had arrived at her door. Maria could feel her caller's sorrow, another grieving mother, one she must help at all costs. The woman was the English wife of a well-known Dutch minister, who introduced herself as Hannah Decker. As soon as Maria heard that the stranger had the name of her beloved adopted mother, she was certain this stranger was the woman who would lead to her daughter's rescue.
You receive what you give threefold. Save someone else's daughter, and you'll rescue your own.
Hannah Decker had searched out Maria Owens in desperation. Her daughter was in the throes of a fever that had grown worse with every passing day. There seemed nothing to do but watch the poor child sink more deeply into sickness and pain. The family's dear friend, Dr. Joost Vanderburg, an esteemed elder with the Dutch Reformed Church and a physician, had found no success in fighting her affliction. He had given the girl an elixir made of crushed bones collected from crypts, thought to heal bone pain, but to no effect. If anything, the girl grew weaker. Hannah Decker had overheard furtive conversations about Maria Owens that took place among women when they thought no one could overhear. She didn't believe in witchcraft and had no experience with the nameless art, but when there was nothing left to try, it could not hurt to believe in something,
however preposterous it might seem. Hannah made it clear that she was willing to pay any price for a cure.
"When your daughter is well again, you can decide what it's worth," Maria said as she gathered her cape and her black bag of herbs. She would have her payment, but it wouldn't be silver or gold. Save a life, win a life.
She knew of Jonas Dekker by reputation. He was prominent and well-respected within both the Dutch and British communities and had lived in Boston, but was more comfortable in New York, among more free-thinking individuals. Seeing as the girl was too ill to leave her bed, Maria would call at the Dekker's home, something she rarely did. When she arrived, the family's lavish mansion appeared to be a house in mourning, with the damask curtains drawn and the candles and lanterns snuffed out. Maria was led upstairs by a servant and then asked to wait in the dim hall. Dutch paintings lined the wood-paneled walls, and hand-knotted French carpets could be found on every floor. All the same, wealth was no protection from sorrow, and when Maria entered the bedchamber, she felt great compassion for the patient, a pale 10-year-old girl named Annika, who writhed in pain. Annika was in a fever, her bedclothes drenched, her delicate face set in an expression of agony. The girl's mother could not look at her without bursting into tears. They had tried leeching and cupping, none of it effective. And Dr. Vandenberg had been stymied in his diagnosis, for he was most familiar with diseases of the Netherlands and New York and the Massachusetts Bay Colony, and this girl was in the grips of a tropical disease. Maria immediately recognized the illness as breakbone fever, so common in the West Indies. The family had been to Aruba to visit relatives, and when questioned closely, Hannah recounted that the children had often been at the shore, where mosquitoes clouded the sky on hot summer evenings. Maria had brought along a selection of dried and fresh herbs, including two it was clear the girl needed. Dried blue violets as a tincture for mouth sores, and linden root and yarrow for a racing heart, for the child's heart was pounding so hard she kept her hands on her chest, frightened her heart would fly out from her body. Fortunately, Maria kept tawa-tawa at hand and grew it in pots on her windowsill, ready if Samuel Diaz should return with a recurrence of the disease, though it seemed unlikely he would ever come back, for she hadn't received a single letter from him since his departure. The Dekker girl's illness was far worse than Samuel's. She had begun to bleed internally, and when she cried, her tears were red. There were purple bruises blooming along her arms and legs. She could barely stand to be touched without crying out. She could not open her eyes when asked to do so, for she was too weak. Maria decided she would stay beside her patient until there was some improvement. On her way via a small corridor to the kitchen that was attached to the house, she passed a room that was filled with books. She went inside and stood at the desk. The minister had been working on a letter, open on his desk. Too much is attributed to the devil and the witch or sorcery. The minister was well acquainted with the Mathers, a family that had been instrumental in the witch trials, whose beliefs Dekker had come to believe were ridiculous opinions for godly, rational men. Maria thought over the minister's writings as she soaked clean rags in cold water and vinegar to bring down the girl's fever, and then asked the cook to begin a fishbone broth. She boiled water to make tawa-tawa tea for her patient and courage tea for herself. There was a reason fate had led her here, and she wished to be strong enough not to back down from what would come next. She was fighting darkness, which arose when it was least expected, in this case in the heart of a young girl, her own daughter. Though the minister's wife did not believe in magic, she said nothing when Maria poured a line of salt along the window ledge and hung the brass bell above the door, or when she dressed the child in a clean blue nightdress. Maria rubbed rosemary-infused oil over Annika's aching bones before spooning tawa-tawa tea between her parched lips. The poor child had been speaking to herself in a fever. She wished to be put out of her misery and no longer had the will to live. Hannah sat on a chair beside the bed, quietly weeping until Maria whispered they must show the girl they had faith in her recovery. She then went to tend to the child. "We will rid you of misery, and you will live until you're a very old woman with white hair," Maria assured Annika. "But you will never be a child again," she thought, "not after such pain. You will be a person of compassion who will be unable to walk past another's suffering without doing your best to aid them." She crooned Hannah Owen's song, the one that had comforted her when she was a babe, and that she had then sung to Faith on board the Queen Esther and in the woods of Essex County. Annika begged for her to sing it again and again, and Maria was happy to comply, for the song always reminded her of home. "The water is wide, I cannot get o'er it, and neither have I wings to fly. Give me a boat that shall carry two, and I shall row my love and I. When cockle shells turn silver bells, and mussels grow on every tree, when frost and snow shall warm us all, then shall my love prove true to me." The minister heard the tune and came to stand in the doorway of the bedchamber, dismayed by the old folk song as he stood watching the stranger care for his daughter. It was a song sung by the cunning folk, people he held in low esteem. He watched as Maria washed the child's matted hair in a bowl with warm water and black soap that had a distinctive sweet scent. Rose and rosemary, sage and lavender. Maria had a beautiful, clear voice, and Annika, who had tossed and turned in the throes of pain, at last lay quietly, taken up by the song. Her improvement was so quick, it appeared that magic was at work, had there been such a thing, for the minister didn't believe in enchantments, only in the ignorance of those who had faith in sorcery. Maria did not leave Annika's side, remaining by her bed, where she hemmed the girls' nightdresses with blue thread. The minister drew his wife into the hallway. "We don't know a thing about this woman you've brought here. Who's to say she won't poison our daughter with her potions?" Hannah Decker went to her knees and begged her husband to allow Maria Owens to continue to treat Annika. When he saw how distraught his wife was, the minister had no choice but to agree. Still, when he returned to the room later that night, he found that Maria was burning a white candle onto which she had carved the name of the disease, the name of the child, and the date. He was ill at ease, and insisted on tasting the tea Maria was feeding the child. Once he had, the bitterness of the drink worried him. "Will this not make her more ill?" he asked. "I know breakbone fever, and you either will trust me to do my best, or I can assure you, your girl will not live." The minister sat beside Maria and watched the candle flicker. He had one child, and Maria knew what that was like. You carried your heart in your hand. "You can have me thrown in jail if I fail you," she told him. "You can have me hanged." The minister exhaled a soft, brittle laugh. "I prefer not to do so. I prefer that my daughter lives." "Then we're in agreement. That is what I prefer as well." Maria was in the corridor carrying a basin of cool water and vinegar when the minister's close friend, Dr. Joost Vandenberg, arrived. The doctor was a tall man, of huge influence, who regularly visited the governors of both New York and Massachusetts, and was highly regarded by all. She overheard the doctor speaking with Decker about the trials in Salem. They were both skeptical that a human being could make contact with the devil, causing death and destruction at that person's will. The doctor believed there were issues with the accusers rather than the accused. It was clear that both he and Decker saw the entire process of witch hunts as insanity. Neither believed that any of the accused could hit and bite victims when they had been seen miles or more away at the same exact time as the attacks. It was lunacy to think such acts were possible, with Jonas Decker stating that the accusers were ill and deprived of their sanity.
The two men were not alone in their opinions. There were many who were in power in Massachusetts who had begun to see that the trials were a sort of hysteria, although some would not understand the horror of what had been done until later. Increase Mather, the president of Harvard, had published Cases of Conscience, making an argument against use of spectral evidence in witch trials, in direct opposition to his son Cotton Mather's The Wonders of the Invisible World, which insisted spectral evidence was valuable in a court of law, with the elder man writing, "It is better that 10 suspected witches should escape than one innocent person be condemned." One man among those in power, who had not changed his mind at all, however, was the chief examiner of the witchcraft trials, appointed in 1692, John Hathorne. He had once been a man who had dived into the water fully clothed, who had stood in the moonlight to pick apples from a tree in the courtyard. When she'd asked him why he had abandoned her, he'd merely said, "People change." Perhaps he wanted to believe this was true, but you were who you were. A person might be changed by ill fortune or circumstance, as Faith had been, but every individual carried a soul within him, unchanging and eternal, a light, a heart, a breath. Dr. Vandenberg brushed by Maria, barely glancing at her. At this moment, his only concern was the patient he'd come to visit. He examined the girl, then went into the study, calling Maria to join him, closing the door so they might speak privately. Vandenberg's brow was creased, and he looked disturbed, not over the state of his patient, who was much improved, but rather in regard to his own apparent lack of judgment and expertise. "I suppose you think I'm a fool." He was certainly looking at Maria now. "Not at all. I've had experience with this illness in Curaçao, and merely recognized it for what it was. You cannot know what you haven't seen." The doctor was grateful for her kindness, though he believed that in this case, he had indeed been an ignorant fool. He was known to be a somewhat arrogant man, assured of his vast knowledge, but he now humbled himself and asked for her method of treatment, and she shared the curatives she'd used, all of a practical nature. Wet washcloths with apple cider vinegar, basil tea with ginger, fishbone broth, all simple enough, but most important was the use of Tawatawa tea, which she would be happy to supply if he came upon more patients with a disease. If she first became ill in Aruba, among her cousins, she was likely infected by them. "It travels in the breath," he concluded. "No, by the bite of an insect. It's not like the pox. You cannot be infected by a person who is ill." "What was your name?" the doctor asked, quite taken with her.
"Maria Owens."
"And mine?"
She stopped him there. "I know who you are, sir." Everyone in New York knew of him. He was so esteemed, a friend to those in power and those in need. The doctor poured two glasses of port from the minister's glass carafe. "I celebrate you," he said. People were usually so dull in his opinion, but not this woman. "I must say, I can't help wonder what it is you'll do next." Maria glanced at his hand. His fortune was changing as he spoke. She had never seen a man's fate change as quickly. When she peered into her own palm, the same thing was happening, a twin to the pattern on the doctor's hand. Their meeting had changed everything that was to come. "Fate is what you make of it," Hannah had told her. "You can make the best of it, or you can let it make the best of you." Maria and the doctor were now tied together by choice, by intent, by happenstance. Fate had made it so, but Maria would make certain it continued to her benefit. When they said their goodbyes later that evening, it would not be the last time they met. While Maria was watching over the vastly improved Decker girl, she came to understand what she wished to receive as her payment for this cure. She knew why the line on her hand ran identically to the doctor's. She found paper and pen and ink in the minister's study and stayed awake till dawn writing, producing a letter that was 3 pages long. By noon, Annika was sitting up in bed, starving and calling for fishbone soup. She wolfed down buttered toast and was strong enough to bathe and have a change of clothes. The girl's mother had been directed in what she must do should the disease reappear, and was aware that it might be a constant fight, though one she could win. "Must you leave?" Hannah Decker asked when Maria began to pack up. "I have a daughter of my own," Maria said. "And you know how to care for Annika." She asked if she might meet with the minister before she left for home. "I've told him to give you whatever you ask for," Hannah told Maria. "I am always indebted to you, no matter what you might need." "I might want something he doesn't expect me to ask for." "No matter what it might be, it's yours," Hannah assured her. The women embraced, for they had been through the darkness together and come into the light of day. It was true. When you saved someone, they belonged to you in some small way, but it was also true that you belonged to them. They would stay with you and enter into your dreams and your thoughts, as you would enter into theirs. Maria found her way downstairs. She had not slept or washed or eaten. Still, she felt elated. She knocked on the door of the library, then ran a hand through her hair before entering when the minister bade her to do so. She thought of the girl she'd been, breathing in smoke, watching everything she had ever known and loved burn, knowing that Hannah Owens had saved her not once, but twice. That was when she'd made a vow that she would never watch another woman burn. "I'm told I must give you anything you ask for," Decker said, gesturing for her to sit across from him. He was grateful to her beyond measure, but also glad that the ordeal was over and that Maria Owens would be leaving. "Name your price." Maria placed the letter on his desk. She had lovely handwriting and a fine turn of phrase. "I want this delivered." Decker picked up the letter, but after only a moment, he turned to her confused. "This is addressed to Governor Phipps. Why are you handing it to me?"
"We share the same beliefs. Neither of us wishes for innocent women to hang."
He gave her a look, then turned back to the letter. Once he'd begun reading in earnest, he could not stop. Maria sat in a velvet chair that had been fashioned in Amsterdam, its feet and arms made of polished wooden claws streaked with a patina of gold leaf. She watched the minister's increasing concern as he read on. 200 people had been arrested, and already 19 people had been hanged on Gallows Hill, and one man had been crushed to death by stones. Maria had heard that Elizabeth Coulson and her grandmother were both in jail awaiting their sentences. Essex County had become a truly dangerous place for women and girls.
"I could not have done any better," Decker said, when he'd finished reading Maria's letter. "I'm impressed by your logic and your prose. It's convincing beyond all measure. But what shall I do with this missive?"
"Ask Dr. Vanderburg to sign it and present it as his own to the governor of Massachusetts."
When Decker stared at her, mystified by this request, Maria went on to explain.
"He's your dearest friend, and he believes as we do. I can tell he's a good man who wishes to do right."
Decker shook his head, displeased, convinced that to have a man sign a letter he hadn't composed was trickery, especially if that letter was written by a woman. But Maria was not about to give up.
"He would have no trouble signing a letter his scribe had written at his bequest. Anyway, it doesn't matter if you think it's a wrongdoing. We are beyond that. Your wife said you must grant my wish, whatever it might be. If you won't help me with the doctor, then I'll have your daughter."
"Pardon me?"
Maria stood, as if to leave the room, and the minister followed her into the hall. If he'd been another less genteel man, he might have grabbed her arm.
"You can't be serious," Decker said.
"Anything I want," Maria reminded him.
your wife will not deny me. I gave the girl her life, and that life now belongs to me. Send her to my house.
She's our daughter, the minister said, shocked by the turn in the conversation. I could have you arrested.
He looked into Maria Owen's gray eyes and saw that she was not alarmed by his response.
My words are not just a threat, he said.
You could do many things, but I hope you will choose to speak to Dr. Vanderburg, and I wish to go with him when he travels to Boston. I don't think he'll mind my presence. Maria went home and packed up everything that mattered to her. Jack Finney would take care of the house, for she might be away for a long time. She might never return. She tossed her clothes into a small satchel so that she could use her trunk for herbs and plant cuttings and bulbs, all wrapped in brown paper. What was most precious was her grimoire, which she would carry in her purse. She went into Faith's room to collect some of her daughter's clothing. Then, overcome by emotion, she sat on the bed. In her hands was the poppet Samuel Diaz had made on board the Queen Esther when he thought he would die, even though Maria had vowed that he wouldn't. "Do you believe me?" she had asked him once.
"Should I?" he had responded.
She took the poppet downstairs, and as she tucked it into the satchel, the fabric tore. It was sailcloth, strong but hastily sewn, a crude toy that Samuel Diaz had told her she must never lose. She'd kept it for 13 years. She had been a girl of 16 then, and was now a woman of nearly 30. When the poppet split open in her hands, she began to cry, an act she should not be capable of, but again and again Samuel Diaz caused her to weep. Perhaps she had inherited this trait from her father, who could cry on command when he was a player in a tragedy. Maria's tears were hot. They burned through the sailcloth as the poppet split in two. Inside, there was a small blue pouch, embroidered with the letters SD. When she emptied the contents, she held 7 small diamonds in her hand. This is what she had seen in the black mirror when she was only a girl. The man she was fated to love, one who never stopped talking, who wasn't afraid to love a witch, who searched for a tree with white flowers that was so ancient it had grown on earth before there were bees. The man whose ring she wore, whose bed she had slept in, who she had foolishly not understood, had always been the one. The house on Maiden Lane was shuttered, the doors locked, the garden put to bed. Maria wore a pale blue dress and her red boots, her dark hair wound up, clasped with the 2 silver clips that had belonged to her mother, which had blackened even more with age. It was not acceptable for a woman to be a scribe, so they would say she was the doctor's serving woman when they arrived at the governor's home. Dr. Vanderburg was impressed by the document Maria Owens had written, and he had signed his name with a flourish. He thought Maria to be quite extraordinary in both her literacy and her strategy. Everything about her appealed to him. "I've asked if you could stay at the governor's house when we reach Massachusetts," he informed her.
"There's no need. I'll be going on to Salem."
When he gave her a look, she added, "I lived there once."
"You were fortunate to leave it," he studied her. "But you'll still go?"
"There are things I need to accomplish there." She'd come to enjoy his company, and said a bit more. "Save a life, win a life."
"Whose?" he wanted to know.
"For you? Every woman who will not be hanged. Each of their souls will be saved by you. And all that is righteous will come back to you."
"And you? What's in it for you?"
"I have a daughter in Salem."
"I see."
Joost Vanderburg looked out at the hilly green landscape. They would spend one night at an inn in Connecticut, but he was beginning to see there was no hope for him. Maria wore a gold ring, and when he'd asked if she was a married woman, she told him only that it was indeed a wedding ring, a very old one,
fashioned in Spain.
"You're such a logical woman, I'm surprised," he said to her. When Maria gave him a look, he laughed and said, "You clearly believe in love."
Vandenberg was a reasonable man, who felt sentiments and passions could be tamed and cured, as diseases were, and that raw emotions were nothing more than a nuisance. He had always believed that madness could easily be born from an excess of feeling. That was what happened in Salem. People's emotions had gotten the best of them, and jealousy, hatred, and fear had turned into self-righteous vengeance.
"Love is many things to many people," Maria said.
"It either is or it isn't," the doctor responded.
Maria smiled.
She enjoyed arguing with this man, a great believer in the rational mind. A fly was buzzing around, and now the doctor reached to catch it in his hand. "This creature exists. We can hear it, touch it, see it with our own eyes. Can we do the same with love?"
He was, in his own way, arguing that she should spend the night with him, that such an engagement was the logical conclusion of minds that were so in tune. He was not afraid of a woman who was his equal, both in his bed and in his life.
"Would you say it was fate that brought us together, or simply that it was the practical outcome of our interests? It's sensible that such a connection leads to desire."
When he offered to take her for his own, his hand held out to her, Maria politely declined. That afternoon, she served the doctor a cup of fall-out-of-love tea, made of ginger, honey, and vinegar. It was one recipe that worked every time. Once they'd reached Boston, it was over and done between them. They were partners in dismantling the witch mania, nothing more. They shook hands, and Maria thanked the doctor for all he had done, both for her and for the accused women of Essex County. He had changed the world, and her world had changed as well. "Never deny who you are," Hannah Owens had told her, "no matter the price." She had a heart, and there was nothing she could do about it. That was why she had left a letter on the table at Maiden Lane in case Samuel returned. She certainly couldn't give her heart to this good, serious man, a logical doctor who didn't even believe in love. What was meant to be had already begun. The future had already been written in a tree, a kiss, a vow, a rope that would fray, a man who did not believe that love could ever be a curse.
Three. John Hathorne didn't often eat with the family. On most days, he left early and came home when everyone was already asleep. But one morning, he came into the room like a windstorm, very much in a hurry, for there was to be a meeting of the magistrates, called at the last moment by a clerk who ran from one judge's house to the other. Fortunately, the courthouse was steps away, and he would have time for some tea and toast at least. He was tall and dark and self-important and handsome, though he was more than 50. His coat was perfectly pressed and his shoes well polished, despite the muck in the streets. Faith took a step back, her breathing labored. It happened to her whenever she saw her father. This man and no other was to blame for crimes against her and her mother and the women of Salem. They had the same high cheekbones and long legs. He pursed his mouth when deep in thought, as she did. And just like Faith, he was particular about his diet. She had made cornmeal pudding and fresh speckled eggs cooked with parsley. She'd risen from sleep while it was dark so she could bake an apple pendowdy, a crusty pastry, perfect for afternoon tea. Apples were used in love charms, but also in spells of remembrance. For that purpose, she had also added rosemary, an entire sprig, finely chopped. Let him recall his actions against them. Let him be haunted by them. Let him repent. That was why she had come all this way, to face him and damn him, so that he would be the one pleading for mercy for once in his life.
Faith wished to be thought of as a servant, and to not have him look too closely at who she might be. So far, he hadn't even noticed her. To assist in the effort of being invisible, she had pulled her hair tightly away from her pale face and drawn it into a knot atop her head. Over that, she wore a white cap, so not a strand of her hair showed forth, for he surely would have recalled her red hair, if he remembered her at all. She used ink to darken her eyebrows and a bit of pencil shaving to turn her eyelashes black. Faith could see that the magistrate carried ambition and worry in his heart. She intended to bring bad fortune into his house with its dull mohair-covered chairs and pine tables. Already her presence was affecting the household. She'd noticed that the oldest son, a handsome boy, a year or so older than she, couldn't keep his eyes off her. Had he never seen a girl before? Perhaps due to their Puritan beliefs, he had never been as close to one as he was to Faith, for his bedchamber was directly above the storage room where she slept, and she had a habit of appearing in his dreams. The younger children paid her no attention at all, which was just as well. They were innocents and had likely suffered from having the same father as she. She had told the mistress of the house that her name was Jane Smith, and said she had grown up on a farm in Andover, and was an orphan who was grateful for any honest work she could find. "My husband will take tea," Ruth Hathorn reminded Faith when she stood there staring. "And perhaps a slice of the pandowdy, for he won't be back this afternoon." "No cake," John said, his nose in his notes for the day's meeting. His children knew well enough not to interrupt when he was at work, and he was always at work. Faith poured him a cup of tell-the-truth tea. She spilled a few drops on the tabletop. He noticed her then. "Who is this?" he asked his wife. "A godsend," Ruth responded. "Jane. She's been here for weeks. She can help me with everything. She's a wonderful baker and very knowledgeable about cooking. She even makes her own tea." The tea supplied from England was so expensive many people drank raspberry tea, called Liberty Tea, which was not half as good as Faith's mixtures. "We're so fortunate," Ruth was happy to say. "Do you have a voice?" the magistrate asked Faith. "I do indeed," she answered. They gazed at each other, and for one confusing moment, each seemed stunned by how similar the other's tone was. Arrogance and intellect. Fine for a magistrate, not so fine for an orphaned girl. Before another breath was drawn, Faith lowered her eyes, though she was reluctant to do so. "I expect I will not be hearing much of your voice while you live here," he said to her. "My house is a quiet one. The voice we listen to is the Lord's." "I thought it was yours," Faith said bluntly. "Sir." The younger children gazed up at her then, and the son, also called John, who had once been a little boy peering at Faith through the white flocks, and who had swallowed his emotions for a lifetime due to fear and fidelity, had a rush of color in his face. The magistrate looked at her again, puzzled. "Go on," he said. "Do what's expected of you." Faith went to fetch the biscuits. Knowing young John watched her as she left the dining room, turning to give him a quick smile. It did not hurt to have an ally here. He was her brother, but by half, and that half did not include the blood that made her who she was. Faith simply could not puzzle out what on earth had made her mother fall in love with John Hathorn. She assumed he must have presented himself wrapped up in a lie, as many men were known to do. When she returned to the dining room, his tea was gone. "The oddest thing just happened," Ruth told the girl called Jane, for she was dazed by her last interchange with John Hathorn. "My husband announced that he was afraid to go to his morning meeting. He thought the magistrates might be disciplined. He's never said that he was afraid of anything before." "Perhaps your presence is a good influence," she murmured.
I doubt that, ma'am, Faith was quick to say.
Tell the truth tea could affect even the most challenging of liars. Those who were false not only to those they loved, but to themselves as well. It seemed her recipe had worked wonders. He'd told the truth to his own wife, an uncommon occurrence.
I'm sorry he missed the biscuits, Faith said. I think he would have enjoyed them.
Ruth patted her arm.
You're a good girl.
The maid appeared to be an innocent, and a poor judge of character who wished to see the best in everyone, even in Ruth's own husband, who was, after nearly 20 years of their marriage, still a complete stranger to her. Faith stowed away bones and leavings from her supper, wrapped them in a handkerchief, then sneaked them into a basket and went off, saying she would return from the market with some vegetables and herbs. She wore her cloak and her boots, even though the weather was fine. The fiddlehead ferns were unfolding. Bloodroot and trout lilies grew in profusion in the marshland. There was a shadow following her, as there always was, her dear wild heart, her other, who pretended to be what he was not, just as she did. People looked out their windows and swore they spied a black wolf that wore a dog's collar, skulking down the cobbled streets, though most in the area had been killed for bounties or for their fur. Faith found her way across the meadows and headed into the woods, allowing memory to lead her. The town had grown, but there was still plenty of wild land and acres filled with pine and oak, old chestnuts and elms, witch hazel and fragrant wild cherry, with its delicious fruit and poisonous seed. At last Faith came to a muddy clearing where Maria had made a path. When she scraped at the ground with her boot heel, the blue stones Maria had carried from the ledge of the lake were still there. The roughly made slatted fence ringing the garden had tumbled down and was covered by wild ivy. There was the tiny tilted house, a neglected hunting shack her mother had worked so hard to make into a home. The windows had been covered with thick translucent paper, but that was torn apart now, for raccoons and weasels had taken up residence inside, and one year a bear had made its home in the cabin through summer and the last smoldering blaze of autumn. The seeds of the grapes he had eaten had sprouted, and there was now wild grapevines growing over the roof, with wide green leaves unfolding. And there was something Faith didn't recognize, the tree Samuel Diaz had brought here from 1,000 miles away, planted in the hours before Maria Owens left Massachusetts. People in town said that if you stood beneath the magnolia, your beloved would come to you, no matter the season or the time. And when its flowers bloomed, those who passed by became confused, imagining there had been snow in May, or that stars had fallen from the sky. Even a bitter, hard-hearted girl could feel wistful upon returning to the first real home she'd known. Faith climbed over the broken-down fence and cleared away the ivy. There she discovered what she was looking for, the apothecary garden. It had gone wild, and there were jumbled weeds abounding, but there were still stalks of belladonna, along with the root that took the shape of a man and was said to scream when plucked from the ground. Faith filled the basket with the ingredients she needed, then noticed that a small sparrow had tumbled from its nest, one more ingredient, fallen into her lap. She took it in her hands, for it was what she needed for her dark spell, the bones and heart and liver. She closed her eyes as she wrung its neck, and as she did so, she could feel the wrongness of her deed, pulsing as if a hive of stinging bees were under her skin. Whoever was charmed by the spell would feel the pain he had caused others. His deeds would be pulled out of him and bite him, as if all his wrongdoings were sharp teeth, and he would feel the stab of remorse. As Faith took the life of the sparrow, Keeper threw back his head and howled, overcome by loss, as if Faith had been stolen from him once again. The sound sent shivers along her spine, but she didn't stop. Her blood was on fire.
When she opened her eyes, the bird was lifeless in the palm of her hand, and Keeper was gone. He was done with her. She was not the person that he had been attached to, the one he'd come to of his own accord. For a familiar can never be called. He must make his own choice, and Keeper had made the choice to leave her. Faith wrapped the bird in a bit of flannel cloth and placed it in the basket of herbs, then went to search for Keeper. There were muddy footprints that led past the lake where she had fed handfuls of bread to a huge eel, but when she searched the cliffs and caves, Keeper was nowhere to be found. Faith cried out for him. She whistled and clapped her hands. Still, there was no sign of the wolf. Her most loyal friend had deserted her, and for good reason. She was not the girl he knew. It is easy to become what your actions have made of you. "Go ahead," she called in a broken voice. "If you leave me, then you are nothing to me anyway." Her face was burning as she ran through the fields. She went back to the house with the elm trees and began to simmer her cursed stew over the fire in the kitchen. When she cut up the bird, the lifeline on her left hand stopped. If she had glanced down that afternoon as she swept the Hathorns' house and boiled their laundry with ashes and lye, she would have seen that she had made her own fate out of bitterness and spite. According to the rules of magic, she would have to pay a price for the actions she had taken that had been born of vengeance.